while we get an arrest warrant. If they found Andrea Strickland still alive, they would have to ask local police to take her into custody while they obtained an arrest warrant from the court seeking extradition. Tracy didn't say it, but she knew Fields would insist on being the one to escort Strickland back to Washington, if indeed she was still alive, so that Pierce County could take the credit. Frankly, she didn't care about the accolades, and since it was a missing persons case, Fields would have the right. The gate agent announced the boarding of passengers in Zone 1. "That's me," Tracy said, turning for the gate.
"I hope this isn't just some wild goose chase," Fields said.
Tracy didn't bother to turn around.
"We'll both know soon enough," she said over her shoulder.
She checked her cell phone for messages while she waited in the terminal for Fields to deplane. Kins had sent a text message asking that she let him know the results of her conversation with Penny Orr. When Fields stepped off the plane, they made their way to the shuttle buses that would take them to the rental car counter for what her GPS said would be a 30-minute drive, traffic always being the unknown in Southern California. Tracy expected Fields to press her for more information, but he remained quiet. The less he knew, she hoped, the less likely he would feel the need to interrupt her questioning of Penny Orr. At 9:30, traffic was heavy but moved at a steady pace. They arrived at Penny Orr's apartment complex at just after 10. Tracy led the way to the second story and knocked three times. When Orr opened the door, she looked curious, though not shocked, which meant she'd viewed them through the peephole.
"Detective? I thought when you called last night you meant that we would talk on the phone."
"Sorry to come unannounced," Tracy said, turning to introduce Fields. "This is Detective Stan Fields from the Pierce County Sheriff's Office. They had original jurisdiction over Andrea's disappearance." Fields extended a hand and introduced himself. Orr looked and sounded flustered.
"I'm sorry, I'm just a little out of sorts."
"May we come in for a minute?" Tracy said. Orr hesitated, then opened the door and stepped back.
"I don't have a lot of time. I'm packing for a trip."
Tracy noticed two large suitcases in the front hallway. "We'll try not to keep you long," she said. "Do you have a plane to catch?"
"What?"
She paused, then said,
"Oh, yes, a little later today."
"Where are you going?" Fields asked.
"Florida," she said, "to visit a friend."
"You're bringing a lot of clothes for Florida," Fields said. "Most people I know live in shorts and tank tops down there."
Orr smiled, but otherwise did not respond. The apartment had the lemon fresh scent of a disinfectant, and it looked as if it had recently undergone an industrial cleaning. The television broadcast the local news. Orr picked up the remote from the coffee table and shut it off.
"Can I offer you something to drink?"
"I think we're fine," Tracy said.
"I had my coffee fill on the plane," Fields said.
They moved to the couches. Orr sat in the same location she had during Tracy's prior visit. Tracy sat on the adjacent couch, Fields to her right.
"You said there might be a development," Orr said. "It must be important for you to travel all this way."
The most logical reason for a police officer to travel two states to talk to a relative of a presumed victim would be to tell them they had confirmed the person's death. Orr looked anxious, but not as though she was awaiting devastating news.
"We think it could be," Tracy said.
She wanted to take a slow approach with Orr and build up to asking her about the birth certificate after laying certain groundwork that would make Orr less likely to deny her involvement. "We spoke to the Mount Rainier search and rescue ranger who conducted the search for Andrea. He's convinced Andrea didn't die on the mountain."
"He is?"
"Yes. He thinks the odds of finding so much of her equipment but not finding her body is unlikely."
"Then what does he think happened to her?"
A rhythmic thumping and metallic clang drew Tracy's attention to the sliding glass door, which was open a crack. Construction equipment worked in the vacant dirt lot next door.
With all the construction in downtown Seattle, she recognized the sound of a machine pounding a pier into the ground.
"I'm sorry," Orr said. "They're building another apartment complex."
"That's all right," Tracy said. "As I was saying, the ranger thinks it's much more likely Andrea walked off the mountain early that morning." Orr didn't immediately respond. Again, Tracy would have expected a relative to have some reaction to the news. Elation, hope, greater concern. Orr finally said,
"But you don't know what happened to her?"
What the ranger is having a more difficult time understanding is how Andrea could have gotten off the mountain without any help.
"What does that mean?"
"It means he believes it's certainly possible Andrea descended the mountain on her own, but if she did, she would have needed transportation to get away."
"But this is just speculation, right? He doesn't really know."
"It could be," Tracy said. "But he's pretty certain she walked off the mountain."
"Then perhaps she rented a car and left it someplace," Orr said.
"Unlikely," Field said. "Rental car agreements are easy to trace. We did a search for her name and the name Lynn Hoff, but didn't get any hits."
At the mention of the name, which Tracy had not wanted to use this early in the conversation, she thought she noticed a flicker of recognition in Orr's eyes, though it could have been recognition of the name from their earlier conversation. Wanting to retake control of the interview, she jumped back in. "Have you heard that name before?" Tracy asked. "Lynn Hoff?"
"No, I don't believe I have," Orr said.
"Who is she?" The ranger believes that to get off the mountain, Andrea would have required some assistance, someone with a car.
"And you think it was this Lynn Hoff?" Orr said.
"No," Tracy said. Lynn Hoff was an alias Andrea used.
"An alias? What for?"
"To get a Washington driver's license and to open bank accounts."
"Maybe a friend helped her then," Orr said, hands in her lap but picking at a fingernail.
"We considered that," Tracy said. "But Andrea didn't have many friends. In fact, according to the people I've spoken to, including you, Andrea really only had one friend. A woman by the name of Devon Chambers."
"Have you spoken to her?" Orr asked.
Again, Tracy watched carefully for any sign Orr was familiar with the name, but she did not get an immediate read. "We don't think she would have been inclined to assist Andrea," Tracy said. Orr seemed to be having difficulty swallowing.
"Why not?"
"We've learned some things about Devon Chambers in our investigation. She appears to have been having an affair with Andrea's husband. She also appears to have tried to take the money in Andrea's trust fund."
"That's terrible," Orr said. "She should be arrested. Have you located her?"
"She left Portland around the same time Andrea disappeared," Field said. "She told her employer she was returning home to the East Coast, but that never happened."
"We traced her to a motel in Renton, Washington," Tracy said. "She'd been using the name Lynn Hoff as an alias."
"I thought you said that was Andrea's alias."
"It was," Tracy said.
"I don't understand," Orr said.
"It means Devon Chambers knew about the alias and about the money," Field said. "She'd used some of the money to try and change her appearance. We think she was going to steal the money and run."
"Do you have her in custody? What does she have to say about it?"
If Orr was acting, she was giving a plausible performance. "Devon Chambers was the woman found in the crab pot," Tracy said. "The one we initially thought to be Andrea. You might have seen it on the news." Outside, the rhythmic thumping continued.
"No,"
Orr said. She paused. After a moment, she said,
"I don't know what to say."
"You told me Andrea never really made any friends when she moved here," Tracy said. "She didn't have any parents, of course, and no siblings. We're trying to determine who might have helped her."
"Maybe someone she knew from Santa Monica," Orr said. "A girlfriend from back then?"
"Maybe," Tracy said. "But that's a huge risk for someone to take for a friend she hasn't seen or spoken with in years." She paused, watching Orr. When Orr didn't speak, Tracy continued. We think it was someone Andrea was close to. Someone who would have understood all the tragedy Andrea had endured in her life. Someone who would have had sympathy for her. Who would have wanted to help her. Who felt an obligation to help her. We can understand that, Mrs. Orr. We can understand why you would have wanted to help your niece.
Me?
Orr scoffed and shook her head. She looked at each of them.
You think I did it? That's ridiculous, I told you. I don't know where she is, or even if she is still alive.
I know that's what you told me, Tracy said, and I understand why you told me. But Andrea was able to obtain a Washington State driver's license in the name Lynn Hoff, because she had a certified copy of a California birth certificate for a woman named Lynn Hoff. A woman who was born here, in San Bernardino, Tracy said. You've worked at the county assessor's office in San Bernardino for many years, haven't you? Orr maintained her composure, though she continued fidgeting with her fingers.
Yes.
And the county assessor's office merged with the county recorder's office and the county clerk's office to cut expenses, didn't it?
So,
Orr said.
So you would have had access to birth records, Field said.
Everybody in those offices would have had access to those records, Orr said.
Her voice shook.
Yes, Tracy said. But not everybody was related to a young woman seeking a new life.
We can get a subpoena, Field said, and find out when the certified copy of the birth certificate was obtained from the recorder's office. Identity theft is a crime.
Tracy refrained from looking at Field. She quickly added, But we're not interested in doing that, Mrs. Orr. Anyone in your situation would have done the same thing, given the circumstances. What happened to Andrea is tragic. If anyone ever deserved the chance at a new life, she certainly did. We just want to find her and talk to her. Tears trickled down Orr's cheeks. She closed her eyes and dropped her chin to her chest, making no effort to wipe the tears away. Outside, the pile driver clanged a steady, rhythmic beat. Slowly, Orr shook her head. Then she spoke in a shaky voice that barely rose above a whisper.
Why?
She opened her eyes and looked at Tracy.
Hasn't she been hurt enough? Why can't people just leave her alone? She didn't deserve any of the things that happened to her. Why can't you just let her be?
She said the last words as if making a plea.
I'm sorry, Tracy said, feeling no elation or even relief. I wish we could. I'm sorry for Andrea, and I'm sorry for you. No one deserves what happened to her, especially so young. I know you were only trying to protect her, and that you believed in your heart you were doing what was best for Andrea. But there are other families now that also have to be considered.
She couldn't do it any other way, Orr said. Not after her husband signed bank documents in her name. She was going to lose the only thing she had left, the only thing that she could use to get away. Don't you understand? It was the only thing she had left that connected her to her parents.
I understand, Tracy said.
No, Orr said, finding her voice and vehemently shaking her head.
No, you don't understand.
My sister was murdered when I was 22, Tracy said. In her peripheral vision, she saw Fields glance at her. Orr looked stunned. I lost my father shortly thereafter. He shot himself. The grief was too much for him.
My God, Orr said. I'm sorry.
My husband at the time also left me. I lost an entire town and way of life, so I do understand why you did it. But some things have happened because of Andrea's disappearance. People have died. We have to find out why. That's our job. We have to find out why for the families of those other victims.
You think Andrea is somehow responsible?
Orr paused, looking to both of them.
That's absurd. Andrea wouldn't hurt anyone. All she wants to do is hike and read.
We still need to talk to her. For nearly a minute, Orr didn't say a word. She sat looking out the sliding glass door. A wisp of black smoke spiraled in the hot air. The machine continued to clang. Fields looked to Tracy, who slowly shook her head. She hoped he had the sense not to speak.
"I want to be there," Orr said finally. "I want to be there when you talk to her."
"Absolutely," Tracy said, feeling a sense of relief, but also excitement. "We just need you to take us to her." Chapter 33 Penny Orr had sequestered her niece in a family cabin in a town called Seven Pines. From what Tracy could determine, Seven Pines consisted of half a dozen houses at an elevation of more than 6,000 feet in the eastern Sierra Nevada mountains, a roughly 3.5-hour drive north on US 395. Orr explained that the cabin had been in her mother's family for more than 60 years. The family had used it to escape the city on weekends and for extended vacations. If a person was looking to get lost, this was the place to do it. The closest city was Independence, with a population of fewer than 1,000. Orr said the cabin had no television, no internet, no cell reception, and an outhouse. Tracy called Foz and told him Andrea Strickland was alive, and Penny Orr was taking them to her. Foz asked if she wanted him to talk to the local police. She told him she didn't think it necessary, but she would call him back if something changed. They decided to take two cars, in case they needed to talk with the local police or seek an arrest warrant. Tracy drove Penny Orr's personal car, with Orr in the passenger seat. Fields followed in the rental. Orr said little during the drive, spending most of the time looking out the passenger side window, fidgeting with her hands and wiping away tears. At one point, she looked over at Tracy and asked, "What will happen to her?" "It's really too early to speculate," Tracy said. "Until we talk to her and get a better idea of what happened and why, I can't say." "What's her mental state?"
"Her mental state? Fine. Why?"
"Her counselor said it was possible Andrea had a break from reality."
"A break from reality?"
"He said she could be prone to violent acts if she became desperate. Have you witnessed anything like that?"
"No," Orr said. "Andrea's not violent. Is that what you think?"
"Do you think Andrea killed Devin Chambers?"
"Andrea couldn't kill anyone. She doesn't have it in her."
"Does she have access to a car?" Orr chuckled.
"Yes, the family kept a Jeep there, but it hasn't been registered in years."
Orr seemed to give this some thought.
"You don't know."
"Don't know what?" Tracy said. Orr looked as if she were about to speak, then caught herself.
"You'll see," she said. "You'll see why she had to run."
As they continued northeast, the US 395 blacktop with its double yellow line cut a sharp contrast to the brown foothills and smothering pale blue sky. They drove past dilapidated one-room miner shacks and abandoned towns of cement-block buildings set amid high desert sage and rabbit brush, cacti, stands of Joshua trees, and fields of jagged lava rock. As they neared Independence, the scenery changed again. The desolate Onion Valley looming, surrounded by the majestic, jagged peaks of the eastern Sierra Nevada. Mount Whitney, sickly gray and snow-capped, rose as the most prominent. Nearly 3 in the afternoon, they reached Independence. Tracy briefly scanned the town for hotels as they drove through the surface streets, in case they had to spend the night. They turned west on Onion Valley Road, a winding ascent into the foothills that, because of the curves, seemed longer than the posted 5 miles. As they approached a stand of trees, Orr said,
"Slow down. Turn here."
They left the asphalt for a dirt road, continuing through the trees and hugging a teal-blue mountain stream. After 100 yards, Orr directed Tracy to a small area cleared of trees where an old Jeep Willys sat.
"Park here. The cabin is just up the path."
Tracy parked beside the Jeep, amazed from its appearance that the car still ran. Fields, following, parked next to her.
"Does she have any weapons?" Tracy asked. Orr shrugged. "My father has a shotgun. He used it to kill snakes.
Where is it located?
In the closet in the bedroom. I don't think it's been fired in years.
Any other weapons? A handgun?
No,
Orr said. She let out a painful sigh.
Can I talk to her first and try to explain? She's not going to understand.
Not knowing the layout of the cabin, and given that there was at least one weapon inside the building, Tracy couldn't allow that to happen.
I'm sorry, I can't do that.
But once we get inside and I secure things, I'll give you time to speak to her. They pushed out of the car. The air had become muggy and thick. Billowing white clouds gathered in the distance over the many mountain peaks surrounding the valley. An oval-shaped, lenticular cloud hovered, like a UFO. Tracy's father had taught her to read the weather so she would not get caught unprepared. She knew lenticular clouds formed when hot air rose and collided with cooler air. On a mountain, such as Rainier, the clouds could be harbingers of the kind of storms that could kill. Orr led Tracy and Fields along a dirt path lined with river stones and railroad ties, the only sound the trickling of the stream and the buzz of unseen insects. Another 10 yards and Tracy saw a wooden walk, a bridge over a stream leading to a cabin nestled among the pines. Forest green with a red door, the cabin sat on a foundation of river stones, with a chimney made of the same rocks protruding above the roof. At first glance, the cabin looked like something out of a fairy tale, where a gnome or elf might live. It made Tracy think of the Alki Point Lighthouse and Dan's desire that Tracy have a fairy tale wedding. It also made her think the cabin was a perfect place for someone whom the world had crapped on to run and hide. After crossing the bridge, they stepped down to dirt, then climbed 2 steps to a small porch. The clunk of their shoes echoed on the wood. Orr knocked on the door. She looked like she'd aged during the drive, like someone about to commit an unspeakable betrayal. Noise inside the cabin indicated someone moving about. Instinctively, Tracy reached across her body and gripped the butt of her gun. Orr didn't wait for the door to open. She pushed it in and called out, "Andrea?" Andrea Strickland had been smiling when Orr opened the door. That smile fell quickly, and her expression changed from bewilderment to the purest expression of pain and resignation.
"I'm sorry," Penny Orr said. So was Tracy.
She now understood what Orr had been alluding to, and why Andrea Strickland had been so desperate to get away. The inside of the small cabin looked like an independent bookstore that had outgrown its space. Stacks of books cluttered the furniture, the kitchen table, and the bench seat beneath leaded glass windows that distorted the view outside. They filled crates in the corners of the room and overflowed bookshelves. Tracy saw hardbacks and paperbacks of every genre, novels and nonfiction, autobiographies. Tracy asked Andrea Strickland and Penny Orr to sit on a 2-cushion couch while she went to the bedroom closet to secure an old 12-gauge crack-barrel shotgun, the kind her father had used in shooting competitions. The gun was not loaded, and it didn't look as though it had been fired any time recently, though it was kept in good condition. She also took a box of shells from the closet shelf. She handed the shotgun and shells to Fields, who set the shells on the mantel and leaned the barrel against the River Rock fireplace hearth. Tracy moved a stack of books from the window seat and sat directly across from the two women. The two-room cabin consisted of the living room and a kitchen area with a tiny wood-burning stove and refrigerator. In the back, the bedroom was not much bigger than the queen-size wrought-iron bed. In the living room, 2 wooden posts extended from beneath the floor to wood-ceiling trusses, and the room retained the smell of burned wood from the blackened fireplace.
"Andrea inherited her love of reading from my mother," Orr said, with a sad smile.
She gripped Andrea's hand.
"Grandma would come here and read 3 books in a day. She wore out the library in Independence, but she didn't like having to return the books. So she bought crates at used bookstores and brought them up here."
Andrea Strickland did not raise her gaze from the bearskin rug on the wood plank floor.
It looks like a wide variety, Tracy said. Do you have a favorite genre?
Strickland glanced at Tracy, then back at the floor.
No, she said softly.
How far along are you? Tracy asked. She'd noticed the telltale bump beneath Andrea's stretch pants. Andrea lifted her head again.
Just a little more than 6 months now.
And your husband doesn't know?
Andrea shook her head. No.
Andrea Strickland was not crazy or vindictive. She had, however, been desperate to get away from an abusive husband intent on killing her and, unknowingly, her unborn child.
Andrea, your aunt didn't want to tell us where you were.
I found the birth certificate for Lynn Hoff. I figured it out, Tracy said. Strickland nodded, or squeezed her niece's hand.
I think you can imagine we have some questions, Andrea, about what happened. Will you speak to me? Does she need a lawyer? Orr asked.
That was always the $64,000 question for the witness and the police officer. Strickland was not in police custody, so her right to an attorney under the Fifth Amendment had not been triggered. She had also not been charged with a crime, which meant her Sixth Amendment right had also not been triggered. Given the location of the cabin and the condition of the Jeep, Tracy now had serious doubts Strickland could have killed Devin Chambers or Megan Chen. She'd faked her own death, but to do so was neither a federal nor a state crime. She had not illegally recovered any insurance proceeds, nor was she seeking to avoid paying state or federal taxes. She'd used a fake identification to open bank accounts, but not to commit forgery or fraud, since the money belonged to her. As for defaulting on the bank loans and the lease, her husband had admitted to forging her name on the personal guarantees. Whether her separate property was susceptible to those creditors remained a civil, not a criminal, issue. In other words, Tracy had no basis to arrest her. The ugly issue of jurisdiction had also resurfaced again. Tracy and Fields had crossed state lines to speak to a witness who had led them to another witness. Without a court order, they did not have authority to arrest Andrea Strickland or to extradite her back to either Oregon or Washington, even if they decided they had a basis to do so. Andrea Strickland had run because she was pregnant. Her husband had planned to kill her, and she'd decided she could not risk him killing her baby or raising a child with such a man. Inside, Tracy was applauding her decision.
At the moment, we just want to talk, Tracy said. If you prefer to have an attorney present, I'll honor that request. It's up to you.
Orr looked to her niece, who glanced up but gave no indication of her desire.
Orr reconsidered Tracy. Can we have a minute?
Sure, Tracy said. Tracy nodded to Fields and the two of them stepped outside. Fields immediately reached for his pack of cigarettes and lighter, lighting up and blowing smoke into the air. In such a pristine location, it seemed a fundamental violation of the beauty of nature.
What do you think? Fields asked. Personally, I think she's nuts. The aunt might be too.
Tracy bit her tongue. Fields was so predictable. I think she's a young woman who the world shit on, who didn't want the same thing for her child.
Your bleeding heart, Crosswhite.
He took a drag and blew smoke into the sky.
What do we do if she won't talk? If we leave, she could run again. She's got all that money hidden someplace, and the aunt had her bags packed and ready to go. I'm not buying the trip to Florida story.
We don't have any basis to arrest her.
What are you talking about? At a minimum, she's a suspect in Devin Chambers' death. She had a clear motive, too, actually, the money and the fact that Chambers was sleeping with her husband.
Tracy almost laughed. Motive, maybe, but not opportunity. Not if she's been living out here the whole time.
Who knows whether that's true or not? She could have driven up to Washington, killed Chambers, and driven back.
Driven in what? That Jeep isn't licensed and doesn't look like it would make 50 miles.
She could have rented a car. She could have driven the aunt's car.
How did she find Chambers?
She hired the PI. She drives down into Independence, sets up a guerrilla account, gets on public Wi-Fi, and makes inquiries. You said there was a lag time in between her emails to the PI and the investigators' responses. This could be why. She was living out here off the grid. She had to go into town to get Wi-Fi.
Does she look to you like she wants to run anywhere? Tracy said. This is heaven for her. No one bothers her. She doesn't have to deal with a world that has treated her like a doormat. She has her books to read, mountains to hike. Why would she want to go anyplace else?
Because she's got a kid on the way, Field said. What? Is she going to give birth in a cabin?
It wasn't a bad point. I'm sure Independence has a hospital, Tracy said. We don't have enough to arrest her. Fields blew more smoke out the side of his mouth.
Yeah, well, if Strickland decides she's not talking to us, I'm going to arrest her.
For what? Tracy said, becoming irritated. You have a missing persons case. Far as I can tell, you found her. There's no crime in anything that we know that she's done. Your case is closed. Devin Chambers is my case, and I can't arrest Andrea Strickland without an arrest warrant, even if I believed I had sufficient cause. Footsteps sounded, someone approaching the door. Penny Orr stepped out onto the porch. Andrea said she has something to tell you. Tracy stepped past Fields and followed Orr inside. Andrea remained seated on the couch, but she no longer looked sullen. She looked shocked and saddened. Before Tracy could say a word, Andrea said, "I killed Devin." Tracy's heart felt like it had leapt into her throat. She glanced quickly at Fields, uncertain what to say, or even if she could get the words out.
"So you killed her," Fields said.
Tracy snapped back to reality. "Don't answer that. Don't say another word." "I didn't mean to," Strickland said. "I just wanted to punish them for what they did to me."
"What did I say?" Fields said to Tracy.
He removed handcuffs from the back of his belt. "Andrea, I'm cautioning you not to say another word." She turned to Fields and raised a hand. Fields stopped. Tracy nodded for him to step back outside. On the porch, Fields wore a shit-eating I-told-you-so grin.
"You see, Crosswhite, you just never know with people."
"Nothing she says is admissible."
"The hell it ain't.
We haven't read her Miranda rights."
"So I'll read them and ask again."
"Just hang on a second, okay? I'm going to drive down into Independence where I can get cell phone reception and make some calls to get some advice. I'll find the local sheriff and ask him to take her into custody until I can get an arrest warrant that includes extradition back to Washington State. You don't need to handcuff her. Where is she going to run? Just read her Miranda rights and make sure she acknowledges them, but do not interview her. This is my case. Are we good?"
"Yeah, we're good," Fields said, smiling. "Like I've been saying, this ain't my first rodeo."
"Keys," she said. Fields tossed her the keys. Tracy left quickly, crossing the wooden bridge and heading down the dirt path to the rental. She backed the car out and punched the accelerator, leaving a cloud of dirt and dust. She turned onto the paved road and drove down the hill with her cell phone in hand, alternately checking for reception and trying to keep the car on the road. Halfway down the mountain, her phone had two bars. She'd missed three phone calls in 5 minutes, all from SPD. She also had one text message from Foz. Alternately shifting her gaze from the winding road to her phone, she read the text. "Call me ASAP. Development in Strickland. Important." She pulled onto the shoulder and dialed the number. It seemed to take forever for the call to connect. Foz spoke before she could say hello.
"Professor, where the... you been? I been... hold of you."
"I'm out of cell range. You're breaking up."
"Professor?"
"Foz?" The phone beeped. The call had failed.
Damn.
She gave a fleeting thought to hitting redial, then decided to get farther down the mountain. She pulled back onto the pavement and navigated the turns. Her phone rang in her hand. She hit the speaker button.
"Foz?"
"Yeah, can you hear me?"
"You're still breaking up." "We got... back."
"Say that again," she said.
"We got the computer."
back.
You got the computer forensics back, Foz? What did it say?
Professor? Foz, can you hear me?
You're really hard to...
Trace the gorilla email account and...
Wi-Fi address.
The email...
generated from a public address.
A restaurant.
I missed it, Foz. Say it again.
A public address. Tacoma. Viola.
The car drifted to the right, onto the dirt shoulder. Tracy hit the brakes, spraying dust and gravel, corrected, crossed the center line, corrected a second time, and pulled to the shoulder and stopped. She sat stunned. Fields. Fields had been looking for Devin Chambers. My God.
Professor?
The phone.
Foz? Foz?
He didn't answer.
Foz?
Foz, I don't know if you can hear me. I'm in a small town in the Sierra Nevada mountains called Seven Pines. Seven Pines. The closest town is Independence.
Foz?
Shit. Foz, call the sheriff. Tell him I'm in need of immediate assistance. Foz? She had no way of knowing if the call was still transmitting, but at least it had not yet died. Tell him it's the green cabin with the red door. First right turn off the paved road. Tell him to... The line went dead. Chapter 34. Tracy debated driving down the hill into Independence, where there was reception, but that would take time, and she'd left Fields alone with Strickland and Orr. Her stomach churning, she turned the car around and headed back up the mountain. It made sense now, at least some of it. Fields had presumed Andrea Strickland was dead. He would have known about the money from his investigation, and believed Graham Strickland killed his wife for that money. When the money disappeared, Fields would have gone looking for Strickland and for Andrea Strickland's only friend, and learned that Devin Chambers had left Portland the same time Strickland disappeared, along with the money. Maybe Fields had withheld other evidence, evidence that convinced him Devin Chambers had taken the money, that she and Graham Strickland had had an affair. Tracy didn't know for sure. What she did know was that to a bad cop, this was like the drug money Fields had spent a decade chasing in Arizona. It was free money. Strickland was presumed dead. Her husband was going to jail. If he could find Devin Chambers, he could find the money. $500,000 in cash for the taking. Fields couldn't use police resources to find Chambers, but he didn't have to. He'd spent a decade pursuing drug dealers, living off the grid in the Arizona desert, and finding their well-hidden money. He knew how they laundered money, and he knew how to get it. The money was right there. All he had to do was kill Devin Chambers and tell everyone she had absconded with it and disappeared to points unknown. That's why he'd stuffed her body in a crab pot, seemingly never to be found. Tracy thought again of her conversation with Kins while sitting in the processing room at the medical examiner's office waiting for the autopsy. Kins had said a body in a crab pot was a first for King County, but it wasn't a first. Pierce County had prosecuted a prior crab pot case just 2 years earlier. Fields. If she was right, he was more than just a bad cop. He was a killer. He'd killed Chambers and he would have gotten away with it, a seemingly perfect plan, until Kurt Schill's one-in-a-million snag pulled up the wrong pot. That brought in another police agency, an agency that was going to dig into the matter. That's why Fields had fought so hard to keep jurisdiction. He didn't want anyone else poking around in his weeds. Once Schill found the pot, Fields needed to make Graham Strickland look like a cold-blooded killer, or at least direct the attention back to him. As the investigating detective into Andrea Strickland's disappearance, Fields had been to the Pearl Street loft, even searched it. He would have known the details on the security at the building, including the keypad in the elevator and on the front door. It also explained Penny Orr's reluctance to provide her DNA. She didn't want Tracy to find out it was not Andrea Strickland in the pot. It was easier for Orr and for Andrea if Andrea was presumed dead. Tracy slowed at the turn for the dirt road. Fields had likely gone looking for Graham Strickland at his apartment and instead found Megan Chen asleep in Strickland's bed. He'd killed her, too. Tracy had no doubt he'd kill Andrea Strickland and Penny Orr, and she'd just given him that chance. Then he'd kill her. Except right now he didn't know Tracy knew he'd been the one to hire the PI to find Devin Chambers. For the moment, at least, Tracy had the element of surprise. She hoped that was all she needed. She drove back slowly to the small parking area, killing the engine the final few feet. She checked her Glock, chambering around, and quietly exited the car. Slowly she made her way up the path, gun held low and at her side. She stopped behind a pine tree at the wooden bridge, watching the cabin, hearing the trickle of the creek and the buzz of insects, but not seeing anyone. She crossed the bridge to the two wooden steps leading to the porch, eyes scanning the area. Glock in hand, she leaned to look in the leaded windows. Strickland and Orr remained seated on the couch. She did not see Fields.
"Don't move."
The voice came from behind her, slow and deliberate. She heard Fields step around the corner of the house and instantly calculated whether she was fast enough to spin and get off a shot.
"Let the gun drop from your hand, Crosswhite," Fields said. "Let it drop, or I'll drop you where you stand." "I said drop the gun."
Tracy dropped the gun. It hit the wood porch with a dull thud. Inside the house, Orr and Andrea Strickland looked toward the window.
"Turn around."
Tracy raised her hands, a subtle signal to the women inside the house, and turned to face Fields. Fields took another step from around the edge of the house, gun raised and pointed at her. Tracy knew she'd made the right decision. Fields would have shot her before she'd turned.
"You're back awfully soon," he said, kicking the gun away. "Much too quick to have located the local sheriff and made your calls. I'm guessing that when you got partway down the mountain you got cell reception, about the same location I noticed that I'd lost it. And I'm betting you got an interesting piece of information concerning a certain guerrilla email account. Am I right?"
"Why, Fields?" Tracy asked, the words bitter in her mouth. Fields smiled.
"Why not?"
"When did you turn?"
"Turn? Interesting choice of words. Let's just say I picked up a few bad habits working undercover. You see, I realized that with every bust, there was all that money unaccounted for, untraceable, not to mention all that product. I'd spent all my time learning how they distributed it so as not to get caught. A fortune. I decided I was playing on the wrong side."
"What about your wife? What about what she died for?" Fields smiled, but it was dark.
"Well, let's just say we didn't see eye to eye on things when she found out."
"You killed her?" Tracy nearly spat the words.
"Depends on your point of view. Drug bust gone wrong," he said, still smiling. "It happens all the time. Agent gets in deep and someone blows her cover. Mine got blown right after they found out about her. No choice but to leave the area."
Tracy had been so fixated on disliking Fields, she wondered whether she'd missed the signs. She could now vividly see all the evidence pointing directly at him. "So when you thought Andrea Strickland was dead, and that her husband had killed her, you saw a chance to get her money?"
"You met him. He certainly didn't deserve it."
"But you didn't count on someone having the same thought and beating you to it."
"It was almost comical when you think about it, the way Devin Chambers played him. Beautiful, really. Poetic justice. She actually offered to split the money with me. I had to give her credit for ingenuity, but I couldn't go through life worrying about her coming back or doing or saying something stupid."
"And the Pierce County crab pot case, was that yours?"
"No, but I did admire that guy's creativity. It's even better than leaving a body in the desert for the animals to feed on. In that instance, you still got bones. Drop a crab pod in the water and there's nothing left of the person, unless some kid hits a one-in-a-million snag and pulls up the pot."
He shook his head.
"What are the odds, huh?"
"Yeah,
Tracy said. What are the odds? But it doesn't matter now, Fields. Look around you. Where are you going to go? His smile broadened.
Are you kidding? Anywhere in the world. I got everything in that bag I brought with me. Fake passports, disguises, this gun. Who knows where it came from? I used to pick these things up half a dozen at a time. It's untraceable. So by the time anyone finds what's left of the three of you out here, if they find you, I'll be long gone. Hell, they might even think my body is out there somewhere, too, dragged off by the wildlife. I take Orr's car, or maybe the Jeep, and I drive out of here. I told you, Crosswhite, the desert used to be my home. Now it can be yours.
Chapter 35. Fields directed Tracy back inside the house, where they both got a surprise. Penny Orr and Andrea Strickland no longer sat on the couch, and the shotgun no longer leaned against the River Rock fireplace.
Shit, Fields said, keeping the gun on Tracy as he moved to the back of the cabin and glanced into the room.
Tracy felt a breeze from the bedroom and couldn't help but smile. Fields swore and removed the handcuffs from his belt.
Hug the post, Crosswhite.
He motioned to one of the two floor posts bracing the ceiling. Tracy didn't immediately move. You know you're not going to get away with this, Fields. She wanted to give Andrea Strickland and Penny Orr as much time as possible to get away. Orr had said Strickland liked to read and to hike, that she had hiked these mountains growing up. Hopefully Strickland knew the area well, knew its hiding places. Tracy doubted Fields would kill her and risk leaving blood in the cabin, so she decided to push the situation.
I've already called my office, Fields. My guys have people on the way. They know you were the guy who hired the skip tracer.
Viola? Seriously? She laughed.
What the hell were you thinking?
Fields stepped forward, the muzzle of the gun just a foot from her forehead.
I was thinking no one was going to find the body. Now hug the damn post or I'll drag your body into the mountains, shoot you, and let the animals eat your intestines. I don't really give a shit.
Tracy stepped forward and put her arms around the post. Fields snapped on the handcuffs, started off, then stopped.
I never did like you,
he said, and swung the butt of the gun, striking her at the temple. I sensed something wrong as soon as Detective Crosswhite left the room to drive back into town. The other detective, Fields, stepped outside and watched her leave. He returned, smoking a cigarette. "Can you smoke outside?" I asked, thinking of my unborn baby, as well as the large amount of paper in the cabin. He smiled and flicked ashes onto the floor.
"Yeah, a fire out here would be a problem, wouldn't it?"
I meant the smoke.
You don't need to worry about that. So, Andrea, where's the money?
With that one question, I knew Stan Fields had killed Devin Chambers. I'd set her up, just as I'd set up Graham, but it had never been my intent for either of them to die. I only wanted her to be punished for what she and Graham had done, what they'd tried to do to me. But ultimately, I knew what I had done had led to her being killed. I felt like I had killed her.
I don't know what you're talking about, I said. Don't you have it?
Another smile.
You're good, I'll give you that. I don't blame you for setting your husband up, by the way. Having met him, I think he got off easy. You had me fooled. I was dead certain he'd killed you. The question was, why? These things are never complicated, though. It's usually a girlfriend out there or money. Insurance. Sometimes all three. So I did some digging, and I found out there's also a big pile of cash unaccounted for. If I can prove he killed you, he's going to jail. And there isn't anybody else out there who knows about the money or cares.
He flicked his ashes on the floor again.
Except the girlfriend turns out to be worse than the husband. She played him for the money, then went missing the same time you and the money disappeared. So I pulled a search warrant for her apartment and for her workstation, grab her computers, and I find a nice trail of evidence that she and hubby were doing the nasty, and she had your alias, Lynn Hoff. Tell me, was that part of your plan to set her up?
I never wanted her to die, I said. I just wanted to get away from them and give my baby a better life, the kind of life I had before the car accident. I never thought she'd go after the money.
You see, your problem was you underestimated her. She was a first-rate con, and to a con, it's all about the money. They don't see things the way you and I see things. They're wired differently. They see your money, but to them, it's their money. You just have it temporarily, until they can take it from you.
So you killed her?
Fields shrugged. Had to. But before I could move the money, someone beat me to it. That's when I figured you were still alive. No way Graham knew where the money was, nor would he go after it with me pushing the DA to name him a person of interest in your disappearance. So I'll ask again. Where's the money?
I didn't answer. Fields dropped the butt of his cigarette to the floor. It glowed red, smoldering, but he made no effort to crush it with his shoe. He removed his gun and pointed it at my aunt's head. I was about to speak when Stan Fields turned his head at a sound outside, a car engine. He stepped back to the door and looked out. I knew it was a car. I'd become accustomed to the noises out here.
"Stay here," he said. "Move, and I will kill you both."
Tracy's head ached as if it had split open. As darkness gave way to blurred images, she realized she sat slumped on the floor of Andrea Strickland's cabin, handcuffed to a post. She pulled her body closer to the post to remove the strain on her wrists, wincing at the pain. She lowered her head and touched her fingertips to her scalp. When she pulled back, her fingertips were bloody. Slowly, she struggled to one knee. The room spun like a carnival ride, and she hugged the post to keep from falling over. When the spinning slowed, she managed to get to her feet, sliding her cuffed wrists up the pole. Nauseated, she fought the urge to throw up and waited for her vision to clear. When it did, she had a bigger problem: getting free. She looked up. The post had been bolted to the ceiling crossbeam with a metal bracket. She looked down. The post went through the floor, likely bolted to a foundation pier. She tugged on the post anyway. It didn't budge. The cabin had been built to last. The post wasn't going anywhere. Outside the front windows, the sky had darkened, but not from the passage of time. The weather had changed. The distant clouds had rolled in over the mountaintops, everything a rapidly darkening gray. Thunder rumbled in the distance, miles off, and the wind had also picked up. She hoped the dark sky and weather would help to hide Andrea Strickland and Penny Orr. She looked around the cabin for anything she might be able to use to get out of the cuffs, seeing nothing, growing more frustrated by the minute. She hoped, at least, that Andrea Strickland knew the mountains, knew a place to hide, and would maybe ambush Fields with the shotgun. She heard what she thought to be another burst of thunder, then she realized it was the sound of boots on the wooden bridge. Someone coming. Fields? She stepped around the pole so the wood was between her and the door. A uniformed police officer crossed in front of the leaded windows. He wore a khaki-colored shirt and forest green pants.
"Hey! Hey!" Tracy called out.
The deputy stepped over something on the walk and stepped inside, hand on his gun.
"Are you Detective Crosswhite?"
Foz. Her message had gotten through. Foz had not let her down.
Yeah, I am. Did you see anyone else out there?"
"No. My badge is on my belt." The deputy stepped in. He looked mid-30s, shaved head, well-built.
"We got a call from Seattle, said there was an officer in need of immediate assistance."
"That would be me. There's a guy around here with a gun, so keep your eyes and ears open. You got a key to the cuffs?" He holstered his weapon, moving quickly to undo her handcuffs while keeping one eye on the door and window. Cuffs off, Tracy rubbed circulation back into her wrists. "Tracy Crosswhite," she said. "Seattle PD."
"Rick Pearson," he said. "Inyo County Sheriff's Office. What's Seattle PD doing way out here?"
"Came to talk to a witness. How many cars did you see parked out there?"
Two,
and a jeep. What the hell is going on?
Fields was still here. Is it just you?
Yeah, we're a substation in Independence. There's another deputy working who I can call in, and I can call down to the main office.
Where's the main office?
She moved to the porch but had to brace herself against the door frame when she became suddenly dizzy.
That's a nasty cut on the side of your head.
Tracy touched the wound and shook away more cobwebs.
Where's the main office?
Bishop.
How far is that?
45 minutes.
We're going to need as many people as you can get.
She stepped onto the porch and retrieved her Glock. And vehicles equipped for driving out in that terrain.
Vehicles won't get far out here, especially not with a storm rolling in.
The storm was a problem Tracy hadn't considered. She moved across the bridge, back toward the parked cars.
There are 2 women out there and a bad cop who's going to kill them if he finds them. What kind of firepower do you have in the car?
They approached the deputy's white and green SUV.
Shotgun and a rifle. Extra rounds.
I'm going to need the rifle, she said. You radio for all the help you can get. When they get here, tell them we're looking for 2 women. One is mid-20s and the other is mid-50s. The guy with the gun is mid-50s, gray ponytail and mustache. He's armed and extremely dangerous. You got a first aid kit?
First aid? Yeah, always.
Radio for help. Then I'd appreciate it if you'd quickly bandage my head.
Where are you going?
Tracy looked at the scrub and foreboding mountains.
Out there, she said.
That's some wicked country out there, detective.
That's what I'm hoping, she said.
When Fields left the cabin, I turned to my aunt.
He's going to kill us.
He has to.
He's going to kill us all.
We need to go.
Go where? She said.
I could see the fear on her face and hear it in her voice.
The mountains, come on.
I quickly grabbed the shotgun and a handful of shells and hurried to the back of the house. My aunt remained on the couch.
Come on,
I said, more urgently. My aunt got up and followed me into the bedroom. I peered out the back window but did not see Fields.
Hold this.
I handed her the shotgun and slid the window up, but weather and age had warped the sash, making it stick. I lowered the window, put both hands under the rail, and forced it up with all my strength. The window made a screeching noise and raised 6 inches higher before again becoming stuck. I wasn't sure we could fit, but the window wasn't going any higher. I took back the shotgun.
You go first.
My aunt ducked down and wriggled her body headfirst through the window. I grabbed the back of her legs to keep her from falling. She dropped the last foot onto the ground. I handed her the shotgun and slid through the opening, out onto a bed of rocks and pine needles. I got up, quickly brushed off my hands, and took back the shotgun. I heard Fields say,
"Don't move."
For a moment I thought he was speaking to us. Then I realized he was standing around the corner of the house talking to someone else. We needed to move. Fast. My grandfather had cleared the trees around the cabin, a fire break. The tree line and cover were about 10 yards away. Overhead the sky continued to cloud over, what was sure to be an afternoon thunderstorm, which was not infrequent in the mountains. It got hot in the valley, and the hot air rose and met the cold air over the mountains. Day would become night in minutes. Thunder would shake the house, and rain would become a torrent, turning the creek into a river. Hopefully, it would be enough to hide our escape. It was our one chance. I grabbed my aunt's hand and pulled her behind me, climbing the incline into the trees and hurrying along the footpath that I'd walked as a child, and daily, since my disappearance on Mount Rainier. Tracy slung the rifle over her shoulder and made her way to the house, going around the back, seeing the open window.
Good girl, she said.
She was really starting to like Andrea Strickland. The young woman was resourceful. She was a survivor. She moved quickly to the tree line, saw what appeared to be a footpath, and followed it in a slow jog that made her head ache. The dry and barren terrain was nothing like the North Cascades, which were green and damp. This terrain reminded her of Lower Rainier, high rock formations, jagged peaks and stones, but also a few pine trees, flowers, and scrub. The altitude burned in her lungs. Lactic acid made the muscles of her legs ache, and the wound on the side of her head throbbed, making her even more lightheaded and nauseated. After several hundred yards,